Thank you, Teresa. Thank you for melting out here with us. Ladies and gentlemen, we are so fortunate, I say this every day, to have Teresa Eamon. She is so talented and so wonderful to work with. She's become a very good friend and a big supporter and a big part of Warbirds in Review. I try to go through my thank yous and my welcomes very quickly. Oh, by the way, I'm Connie Bolin. This was my idea 23 years ago. And I'm now still the coordinator of Warbirds in Review, so thanks to all of you, you have made it a big success. So thank you. Thank you for being here. And what has really made it a big success is I don't believe in those 23 years I have ever made a phone call to an owner or anybody that restored the airplanes or the reenactors, Teresa. I don't think I have ever asked somebody to be a part of this and to support us that they haven't said, sure, what do you need, Connie? Last night, Rod Lewis said, well, let me know, what do you want next year? You know, Rod, why was your Corsair here? Because you asked me to bring it. Well, so Jim Tobel is a good example. This is Jim's airplane. We had a little bit of confusion which airplane we were going to use a couple of months ago. And I called Jim and I said, I know I can count on you. Would you be part of Warbirds in Review for the devotion? And he said, absolutely. I'm here, Connie, whatever you need. And if you look out here on this ramp, you probably will not ever have an opportunity to see more they're Corsairs. I know the difference. the Corsairs that are out here, I'm going to take an extra few minutes and thank our crew, our line crew, and the people who move these airplanes, coordinate with the owners to get them moved and to fill this alley. I know the guys are out here working, and they don't hear me say thank you to them very often, but a shout-out to those guys. If you see them moving, you know, all these airplanes and running around, take a moment to say we appreciate you, and they will very much appreciate your support. And speaking of appreciation, we could not monetarily support this without the support of Scott's Miracle-Gro Company, and we could not operate with this production crew that is so talented without this building behind us. We have a green room. We have the production crew. They have a nice place to operate only because of Ron and Diane Fagan's generosity. So to all of our volunteers who make this happen, to you who join us here and support us, and I know it's very hot out here today, so I'm going to stop this conversation I'm having with you now very shortly, and we're going to show you an introductory video that tells you a little bit of the history of the movie Devotion, and it's going to be our honor. I will leave it to our moderator today to introduce our guests to you, but you're here because you probably know who we have already. So General Ed McElhenney will be out very shortly after we watch this film to bring you the Devotion presentation. Direct your attention to the film now, and very quickly, Sleeping Dog Productions. They are very, very talented, and as Teresa said, the air-to-air TV is something that is very, very worthwhile. So I thank you to my professional production crew led by Scott Guyatt and his wife, Kyle, who's right here. Kyle does everything that I need her to do and more. Ladies and gentlemen, the video. Enjoy Devotion.
Tell you what, Adam, we're going to put Joe here with his son behind. Adam, you can sit there, and then we'll get Jim on the end. You get the left seat. That's exactly right. You got the, yep, Jim, that's yours back there. All right. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Warbirds in Review. Ed McElhenney, if you've been here before, you've seen me a few times. And I will say I am distinctly honored this morning to bring this program to you. We have three distinguished gentlemen up here that you already saw the video. And we're going to get into some detail about what really went on there. Again, you can read the sign here, History, Heroes, and Heritage. That's what you're looking at here. And that's what we're going to be discussing today. So without further ado, our guest of honor, I'll introduce first. And it's arguable right now. We thought it might be in the world, but at this point, for sure, the oldest United States military fighter pilot alive right now is Colonel, retired United States Marine Corps, Joe McPhail. I agree. I think he gets a standing ovation also. Thank you. Our focus, as you can tell today, is Korea. He is a World War II vet also, but he's going to be speaking more about Korea than anything else. Next in line, you saw the video again, three-time New York Times best-selling author, Adam Makos. He's the guy who made all that happen. And so Adam is here to talk about how it got started, and you saw the end result. I'm just curious, how many people have seen the movie? That's pretty impressive. And I'll say now, read the book also. The book is great, and Adam will be signing that book, by the way, afterwards, back in the merchandise building back there. And last but not least, we've got the guy who brought this beautiful airplane here today, Jim Tobel. And he has a great history with Corsairs, with he and his dad. Again, beautiful airplane. And he's going to be the hands-on kind of guy to talk a little bit about the walk around. You've seen him fly already here, I don't know how many times. He's going to be doing some more flying. And I also thank our ground crew for, I think there's 8 Corsairs out there right now. I feel like I'm in a Corsair squadron right now. You know, it's really, really kind of cool. So the program is going to be, we'll have a little discussion with Adam. After that, we're going to get some stories. And I'll throw it out there right now. You know, the date was, what, December 4th, 1950, when the event occurred with Jesse Brown and Tom Hudner. And again, I told you that Colonel McPhail was flying in Korea, flying Corsairs, and the discussion just back there, just, I mean, 10 minutes ago, you know, it's like, well, could he have been in there? Could he have been flying there? His son Chris has got the logbooks. We pull out the logbooks. No kidding, I'm not making this up. He pulls out the logbook, and guess what? On December 4th, 1950, he was flying a Corsair over Chosin Reservoir. So he was there. And again, you'll hear more about that story. But again, you talk about a small world. Very, very impressive. So with that, I'm going to open it up to Adam and just say, okay, Adam, how did we get here? You know, the story was there. And I guess it started with you and meeting actually Tom Hudner, and then going from there to saying, hey, I'm going to write a book. And then somebody said, hey, I'm going to do a movie. And so I'll open it up to you right now, Adam. Go ahead.
Well, thank you so much, Ed. And if Tom was here, I think he would just be in awe, because look around us. And we're here to talk about the Korean War. That's the most important part of this whole journey. We're not just talking about Tom Hudner and Jesse Brown. We're talking about an entire forgotten generation of American warfighters. The last Korean War movie was made in 1956. That was Porkchop Hill. Before that, or after that, we had shows like MASH. And that is not quite the legacy you want for the Korean War. So Tom played a big part in changing that. The reason I say that is I was a young journalist back in 2007 when I saw Tom Hudner, a Medal of Honor recipient, speaking in Washington, D.C. to a group of school kids. And I caught part of his presentation, and they were talking about this guy who crash-landed a perfectly good Corsair to try to save a friend. And when it came time to leave that event, I saw him there in the hotel lobby. He was reading his newspaper. He was all alone. And to me, that was like seeing the one of the Beatles or one of the Rolling Stones, sitting there completely ignored by everyone around him. Because, you know, he was just some 80-year-old guy there and in his blazer and his tie. And yet I had that little sample of who he was, and he was someone remarkable. But I didn't know anything about the Korean War. So when I went up to him and I said, "Sir, I'm a writer for a small magazine, and I'd like to tell your story." And he handed me that business card, and he said, "Contact me. I'd love to talk to you." It put me on a journey that I didn't quite appreciate that battle, the Chosin Reservoir. I didn't appreciate that war. I didn't really appreciate Tom as much as I should have. Now, all these years later, I realize that his act of heroism was as special as it looks on the big screen. The captain of his carrier, the USS Leyte, at the time said, "There has been no finer act of unselfish heroism in military history." And that's a pretty big claim. But when you think about it, no one before or after has ever crash-landed a perfectly good aircraft to try to save a friend. So Tom Hudner does stand alone in that respect. And by giving me that story, it began a journey that took 15 years from that day in 2007, and now here we are.
Okay, and how did it morph into the movie? You know, Fred Smith was a big part of that initially, friend of Connie's, by the way, and I was privileged to attend the premiere back at the Burke Theater in Washington, D.C., where I truly met Adam for the first time. But I was also able to meet the actors. Tom Hudner's son was there and others. And yeah, it was absolutely spectacular. But Fred was the guy who, you know, said, "Hey, let's try to do something with this," right?
Absolutely, Ed. Fred Smith, many of you have used his product, Federal Express. And a lot of people don't know that he was a Marine in the Vietnam War. He has a Silver Star, a Bronze Star, two Purple Hearts. He led a rifle company, K-35, which was a famous unit in World War II. Eugene Sledge, his unit. And then Mr. Smith led that in Vietnam. So he's paid his dues for our country, and he's a huge supporter of the military in more than just talk. In the case of this story, Tom Hudner and I got this ball rolling, but this young actor named Glenn Powell came to me one day, and he said, "I read your book, and I want to play Tom Hudner in the film." And at this point, there was no film. And Glenn was still a fledgling actor, and he was doing Netflix shows. And I said to him, "Well, you want to play Tom Hudner, that's great, but do you want to meet the real Tom Hudner?" It was kind of a test, because a lot of Hollywood is Hollywood. And if he was that way, I'd be walking the other direction. Instead, Glenn said something really remarkable. He said, "When and where?" 1 week later, we were sitting at Tom Hudner's kitchen table. Georgia Hudner was making us waffles, and Tom was telling the story of Jesse Brown and these events long ago. And I remember watching Glenn walk with Tom to the door, arm in arm, and I said, "Okay, we found our actor." That night at dinner, I said, "Glenn, how do we get this thing made?" And he said, "Well, I know the right people." He said, "I know the Smith family. Rachel Smith and Molly Smith are producers in Hollywood, and their father is Frederick W. Smith, founder of FedEx. And he loves this story, and he loves Tom Hudner. He was a Marine, and he wants to do something for the Chosin Reservoir." And what he did was to open up his pocketbook in a big way. When a lot of people are, you know, buying themselves yachts and this and that, he went and bought us a movie. He bought a movie for our country, and he made the first Korean War movie, every penny out of his own pocket. Because Hollywood wasn't going to take a chance on devotion. They hadn't done that for 56 years. They weren't about to start. They're risk averse. You know, if it's not Marvel, we're not going to make it. And so Fred Smith stepped up and saved the day, and we got this incredible movie. And I can tell you at some point about stepping onto the set, because the set was epic.
I'll go a little bit beyond that. And when I was at the premiere, I had a chance to meet Glenn. And Connie and I were talking to him, and we were just kind of curious. Here he is pretending a Corsair pilot. And you know, we asked, of course, we're pilots, you know, are you a pilot? And if you have seen that, there's another, what's it called, Top Gun Maverick film out there or whatever it is. Yeah. Yeah. Well, anyway, he's in that one, too. And he said, yeah, as a matter of fact, Tom Cruise offered us flying lessons. You know, if any of us in that movie, you know, wanted to learn how to fly, Tom was going to subsidize us. And you know, Glenn sat there and said, yeah. And so we looked and we said, so what do you got? He says, oh, I'm a Cirrus pilot now. So he got his private pilot license. He's flying a Cirrus now. And the remarkable thing there also, and it might have been that same visit, I'm not sure, but one of the last things that Tom Hudgert said to him, you know, when, and it was going to be, hey, we're going to make a movie about this event. And the one thing that Tom Hudgert told him, he says, get it right. Just get it right. And you know what? I'm here to compliment you, Adam, because, yes, you all got it right. And it is a spectacular movie.
Thank you so much.
And as long as we're talking about the movie like that, Connie got a call from Fred, and I guess there was talk. Connie's got a T6, a yellow T6, and there was maybe a possible need. It didn't work out that way, but if you didn't know that the movie, a lot of these movies these days, there's a lot of computer-generated images on them, and in this movie, not so many.
Not so many at all. It was, from the beginning, they said, we want to use real aircraft, and so they collected four Corsairs and a Sky Raider. It was really funny because I got to see when they started to paint the planes. So the photos start coming into you, and you see the big white K put on the tail, and that kind of warms your heart. And then I said, wait a second, your Sky Raider, it's wrong. Because they had one of the Sky Raiders that was used for, like, anti-submarine hunting, and so it had this big, long, elongated canopy. And I said, that doesn't look like the ones they were using. And they said, we're going to fix it. We'll fix it in post-production. And they sure as heck did. When you watch the movie, it's a real thing. And what they did was they digitally morphed just the portion behind the canopy, mm-hmm. and they made it the correct model of Sky Raider. But these are still all real aircraft. So when you watch the Yalu River Bridge scene, which is one of my favorites of the film, that is really Steve Hinton Jr. flying at 5 feet above a river in Washington State. They had rescue divers on the riverbanks ready to go. It was very, very dangerous and very rare flying. And the funny thing is, we're so accustomed to CGI now that when we see the planes peeling off and we see them diving down, we just think, oh, that part's a computer. No, 99% of the time it's real. And the way I found it out, I got to go on the set and I got to make a little cameo, which was pretty neat. And my brother and I went into the trailer where they make you look like a pilot, and we got these haircuts that were going to be 1950s. So we said, let's look like 1950s guys. So they gave us these haircuts, and they said, you want to go full 1950s? And we said, yeah, hell yeah. And so they slicked our hair back, and so we looked really greasy. We come out onto the set, and it's about 5 in the morning when all this is happening. So it's Statesboro, Georgia. It's a rural airfield, Air National Guard base now. We walk out of the trailer, and we put on our G2 jackets, and we start moving in the direction of the set. And the sun is coming up, and we see this sight that we hadn't seen before, and that is they built an aircraft carrier on this airfield. They literally built the superstructure of the aircraft. So it had the gun tubs, it had the bridge, it had Vulture's Row, it had all the pieces, everything that was the deck and up. And I walked up to it, and the first thing I did was I rapped on it. It was made out of metal. And the next thing, the actors all show up, and they're all getting ready for their first scene. And I look at them, and they all have this scruffy hair, and nobody's slicked down like us. And so when we do make our little cameo, we're these guys that look like we're going on shore leave, like we're going on a hot date, and everybody else looks like real pilots. So that was a lesson. Do your recon first. See what the other guys are wearing. See how they look, and then get cleaned up.
All right. I want to get into some of the the real stuff. And Colonel McPhail, you're the real stuff here right now. Like I said, you do some flying in World War II. In fact, what was it? You call yourself an ace. You shot down two Japanese airplanes, but he said he wrecked three American airplanes. So a generic ace. He calls himself a generic ace. Talking about this movie, this mission, this war, you were flying Corsairs, and I got to ask, how many Corsair missions did you have when you were over there in Korea?
I had about 100.
100 Corsair missions,
yes,
okay?
Sir, right,
and most of those were close air support, were ground attack?
A lot of it was, yes, sir. Close air support, yeah.
Okay, and the ordnance that you dropped in the movie, they showed rockets, they showed napalm, and the guns. Is that probably
napalms and bombs? Yeah.
And the gun.
Guns, yeah.
Okay.
I'm looking up there on that Corsair. You see those three rivets there? That's where the 50 caliber machine guns are on both wings.
Yep.
They also show that piece of balsa wood on the leading edge. That was put on there by the British to help the airplane stall straight rather than the wing drop. And so it improved.
Jim's nodding his head down there. He says, sounds like you got some experience there, too.
Well, if that wasn't on there, I wouldn't fly it.
Yeah.
That's right, yeah.
Interesting. I know you've got one good story about you didn't launch from the carrier every time. You know, you were ground-based for that's what Marines did, you know.
Yeah, that's right. I didn't fly off the carrier very few times. I was land-based nearly all the time.
Okay.
But it was the CVE, Jeep carrier, 600 feet long. And so we qualified, and then the next day went to fly a mission, and they had other airplanes on the deck, and we had to use the catapult to get off. And they taxied me over to the port cat, and we sat there and watched them shoot an airplane off on the right, and they gave me a run-up, and I went up 30 inches and chucked the mags, and I went to full throttle, and I saluted, and away I went. I came back on the bulletin board that put up there, MacPhail the Reluctant Warrior. And I said, what's the deal? They said, but you took off with your brakes on. I know exactly what happened. When I pushed that throttle up, I didn't want to dribble off the end of that carrier. And my feet went up on the brakes. I didn't intend to, but they did.
But there are a couple flat spots on those tires, too.
Huh? Yeah.
Huh. All right. Well, I say thank you. Were the close air support missions that you flew, Adam talked about, in the movie, down low is 700 feet. Were you right down there in the weeds?
Lower than that, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Sure, Ed, yeah. You know, in dropping napalm, what you do, you get down low enough to where the target disappears below the nose of the airplane, you squeeze it off, and you can be pretty accurate. Yeah,
I would
imagine. One time I dropped a bomb in a tunnel that was northwest of Seoul, and fire came out both ends of the tunnel.
Wow. All right, I'll go back to Adam for a minute and just say, the Chosin Reservoir is nationally famous. I mean, it's in the Marine Corps, that's a very special group. And you said you're an associate member. To this day, they have a group, and I don't even know what is it called, just the Chosin Reservoir or the Chosin Few?
Chosin Few, yeah.
Okay. And Adam has done a great deal of research and been involved with all this stuff. But come to find out, this gentleman to my left is also a member because, he was there and he was flying during that time period. And they still get together, is that right? The Chosin Few still get together?
Yes, sir. Yeah, we do. We still get together, right? Yeah. I went out to San Diego to a 323, which was the squadron I was in World War II. and I was the only propeller guy there. Everybody else had, you know, gone in a little later and flying jets. And so I feel pretty fortunate, you know.
Yep. All right. Getting back to that battle, if you will, you know, that was Medal of Honor. Any idea how many were awarded? I'd heard the number 13, something like
yeah,
that. Is that correct?
I was going to say more than a dozen. It was the most in a single battle in American history.
Okay.
So the Chosin Reservoir battle was, everybody thought we were going to be home by Christmas. The war was going to end. Yeah. And then the Chinese jumped in. And they jumped in surreptitiously. As the video said earlier, you know, nobody saw it coming. It was an ambush by 100,000 men in the West. And then the 1st Marine Division was motoring up to the North Korean border. They thought the war was going to be over. They were 30 miles south of the top of North Korea. That was going to be it. Oh. And the Chinese were so threatened by the idea of perhaps having a democracy on their border that they sent these troops in. They called them all volunteers. They were not, and they were Chinese soldiers. And it's sad. You kind of see that today. You know, they're not our guys. Yeah, they are. Yeah. And it produced this incredible battle. And to follow up to something Colonel McPhail said, I interviewed a Corsair pilot named Sam Folsom, and he said when we would run out of our guns and rockets and napalm at the Chosin, he said we'd try to hit them with our propellers. And I didn't doubt it, by the way he said it. The Marine and Navy flyers, there were two Navy carriers parked off the coast of North Korea and then several Marine squadrons. And they were really the lifeline because you essentially had 20,000 Marines and Army soldiers from the 7th Infantry Division surrounded, largely Marines, 1st Marine Division, surrounded by about 100 to 120,000 Chinese. And so that numerical advantage was negated by our air power and the M1 Garand rifle. Those two things scared the hell out of them. And so a lot of times the Chinese would attack at night because the planes were roosting. And so when the sun came up, the Marines would say, okay, we live to fight another day. And where's our air power? And then that's when guys like Joe braved incredible weather, you know, fog, snow, conditions that you would normally not fly under, to get under that overcast to deliver close air support. And there were days when I've seen VF-32s after action reports, and they claim, I don't want to say kill counts because it sounds kind of cruel, but they've claimed 2,000 to 3,000 guys that they killed in a day. Chinese troops. And that's the only way these 20,000 Americans and some British commandos got out of the Chosin Reservoir and fought their way to the sea.
And you talked of you know, hey, the airplanes facing this bad weather, but I'd have to say almost more importantly, the ground guys. You know, what were the temperatures down there? I mean, they were sub-zero from what I remember, right?
There were some outposts in the mountains that had registered negative 13 degrees.
Yeah.
So it was easily sub-zero. The day of Hudner's crash when he went in to save Jesse Brown, it was definitely at or below zero. And that was such an incredible factor in this, because when Tom crashed, night was coming. He crashed at about 3:34 in the afternoon. It's winter time. Darkness is coming at 5 or earlier. And so he really put himself in no man's land at last light. And there were only two helicopters at that time operating out of the Marine base, Hagaru Rih. And those helicopters had literally thousands of casualties they're trying to evacuate to the coast. So what are the chances that one of those two is actually going to come 13 miles behind enemy lines to try to pick up one, maybe two pilots? He really put himself in a point of no return. And the amazing thing about it is when I was writing the story, I got to this part where Tom said to him, "We'll be back for you. I'll be back somehow." And I realized at that moment that Tom thought, he thought he might be back the next day. He thought he might be back that night. Nobody saw us necessarily leaving that battlefield. I don't want to say losing the battle, but giving the ground to the enemy. He thought he was going to come back the next day and maybe find Jesse still alive. He thought maybe they'd mount a rescue party that night. But those hills were swarming with Chinese troops. And as they found out soon after, Chinese found Jesse's body. They took his flight jacket. They took everything off him because they were freezing too because the conditions were that bad.
All right. Three things. I hope I can remember them all. But the first one is the temperatures were extreme. The helicopter, the actual helicopter that you saw flying in the movie, that was one of the real helicopters that was used back then. Is that correct?
Yeah, only one in the world.
Okay, that's I understood that. And a follow-on to that, okay, you've got a book called Devotion. Okay, we've got the event. We've got the Medal of Honor. We've got the friendship. We've got... Where did that come from? What was your thought process? What do you want that? What do you want people to remember when you say, "Hey, this is the movie Devotion"? What is the devotion to?
Devotion was a word on Tom Hudner's Medal of Honor citation. It said, "For selfless devotion to a fellow shipmate." That word and what it represented, just when you see the movie and when you read the book. You know, that's just the ethos of these guys. It was devotion to each other, devotion to their country. One of the things that amazed me about this squadron, this unit, this story, is that none of those guys had to go to the Korean War, especially not Jesse Brown. Jesse Brown had a young daughter. He was married. One of the pilots, before the unit shipped off to Korea, he said, went to the skipper and he said, "I'm not cut out for this killing stuff. I should have joined Air Sea Rescue. Can I transfer to a different unit?" And the skipper said, "Well, we don't want somebody like that coming to war with us because he might get us killed." So they let that guy stay home. And he went up to upstate New York. The Navy kicked him out. Essentially, they let him go. And he ended up driving a Greyhound bus during the Korean War. Jesse Brown went, and he had an out because there was a president, because one of his friends left the squadron. So that sacrifice is so remarkable. And that's what was so special about Jesse Brown. He didn't, number one, become a pilot just to be a pioneer. He wanted to be a Navy fighter pilot. He wanted to fight and defend a country that didn't necessarily love him back. That's devotion. The devotion between these two men from different worlds. Tom Hudner from the country clubs, Jesse Brown, the son of a sharecropper. Jesse was quietly religious. He had a great sense of humor. He had incredible qualities about him, and that was one of the things that interested me in this story. Everybody knew about that December 4th moment. Tom got the Medal of Honor. What made Jesse Brown so special that you would risk your life to try to save him? And that was that devotion. And then as a kicker, in the end of the film and in the book, we have a letter, and it's Jesse's last letter home that he wrote on December 3rd at night, after having flown to defend the Marines that day. And he said in that letter, he said, "There's not a guy on this ship who wouldn't give it all for those guys on the ground." And he really loved the Marines. In the movie, there's a little bit of drama between them. In real life, Jesse had a great affinity for them. And when he signed off his letter to his wife, Daisy, he said, "Your devoted husband, now and forever, Jesse." Devoted, devotion, magic,
absolutely. And the follow-on to that was, you know, the words that Tom used, you know, "Jesse, I'll be back." Tell me about that, because indeed he went back, didn't he?
He went back, and it's a little still photo at the end of the film that said, "In 2013, Captain Thomas Hudner kept his promise and went back to find Jesse Brown." And it really was the embodiment of no man left behind. The way it came about, it's kind of crazy. I'm writing that chapter of the book, and I called up Tom, and I said, "Hey, did you ever get a chance to keep that promise?" And he said, no, my military career never took me anywhere near North Korea, nor does anybody just go to North Korea if you're level-headed. And he said, I basically asked him, I said, "Would you go?" Because I had written a book called A Higher Call about a German pilot who spared an American bomber. And I knew that impossible things are possible. If it's possible for two enemies who fought each other in World War II to 60 years later find each other, become best friends and fishing buddies, why can't we create a happy ending to this story? And so we contacted some people who do some work in North Korea, and they told us who to get. And we liaisoned with the North Korean army. And it's very rare. When Dennis Rodman went into to the country before us, he worked with the Public Affairs Division, the Foreign Affairs. We worked with the Korean People's Army. And the reason they supported us was because we still have thousands of MIAs unaccounted for. And it's good for the North Koreans to recover them because it means American teams come in. It means American money comes in. They've been an embargoed country for a decade now or more. And so they want to do business with America between the threats. And in this case, they let us come in. Tom Hudner at age 89. We flew to North Korea, and next thing you know, we're sitting down at this table across from the Korean People's Army. And they said something really interesting. Nothing there happens by accident. It's all scripted. For one, you hand over your passport the minute you step into the country. The only safe refuge is a Swedish embassy. We don't really have representation there. And so you're really taking your life in your hands. They said, Captain Hudner, we have a message for you from Kim Jong-un. And that's where it's like, oh, how many years hard labor? Come on. my mom told me not to do this. And they said, Kim Jong-un, the supreme leader, the marshal, recognizes how far you've come after so long to keep a promise for a friend. And he pledges the Korean People's Army will pick up the search for you. And we will look for Jesse Brown. We couldn't find Jesse Brown because when we flew in there, the monsoons hit. The roads to the Chosin Reservoir washed out, and there was no getting there. So we became essentially guests of theirs for 10 days. And we tried to improve relations. But I'll tell you, I've drank soju, you know, which is like their vodka, their moonshine, with North Korean Army. And I'll tell you this, they're human beings like us. And you realize that at the end of the day, the saddest thing that you learn from studying war after war after war is that the average man doesn't want war. The average enlisted man doesn't want it. The average officer doesn't want it. There's just a very few people in this world that set us against each other. You can have dinner with a North Korean person, and it would be easy breezy. It's the leaders that keep us apart.
But thank you.
Yes.
It's not over from what I understand. I mean, there's the search will go on. I think there's going to be more. You said that the pandemic kind of slowed things down a little bit, but I think there still is hope. And,
We were planning a second trip back. The North Koreans, when we were there, they said to Captain Hudner, they said, Kim Jong-un invites you to come back this autumn. We were there in July, and so they're saying, basically, go home to Boston, Massachusetts, and then come on back to North Korea at that age. And it was too much of a journey. We had to say no thank you. They said, come trout fishing in the mountains. We almost got to be the first anglers to go trout fishing in the Chosin Reservoir. they invited that.
But, that's a record.
We didn't get to make that trip. But ever since then, we've been researching the crash site. We've studied it by satellite. And we've come to a conclusion that we know where Jesse Brown is buried. He is buried on that mountainside. After what you don't see in the movie, they say, we're doing a funeral flight. And they have these aircraft take off. The kicker that I didn't even really realize when I was writing the book, I found some documents later, was that the napalm that they were going to drop on Jesse's body didn't go off. They had used so much napalm on the Chinese soldiers there that they were starting to use improvised, they weren't using napalm tanks, they were using drop tanks, and they were putting grenades in them that would set them on fire. And it was a jury-rigged solution, and it wasn't triggering the napalm, and also in the sub-zero temperatures, the napalm wasn't working very good. So when they dropped napalm on Jesse's aircraft, it never went off. So they said, okay, what do we do now? And so they dropped iron bombs on Tom's airplane, and there were some bomb craters on the mountainside there, on the mountaintop there. But none of the guys could bring themselves to drop the bombs on Jesse's aircraft. They said, we're not going to blow our friend into a billion pieces. And so his body, we've since learned, was very likely moved and buried in one of the bomb craters. That's what happens in Southeast Asia when they find a lot of human remains from F-104s and F-4s and so on. The pilots often are put there by the farmers. So we know where Jesse is. The pandemic shut us off from North Korea. Now there's a lot of tension. I don't know if we'll be back anytime soon, but we know where he is. We just got to get in.
Okay. All right, I'm going to transition a little bit to the airplane now. We're going to give Jim a chance to talk about his airplane, but I'm going to ask Joe if there's something that he talks about the airplane that's not right, you know, just wave your hand. Just kind of just sit there because nothing personal, Jim, but I think he's got a lot of time in the airplane. I know it was a long time ago, but he did it for real. And I'm not saying that you're not really flying the airplane, but I just want to give this guy the first dibs and waving the flag if there's something. And it was your favorite airplane, from what I understand. Is that right? Because he was a Hellcat pilot for a while.
Wildcat.
Okay, Wildcat.
Yeah, and then Corsair. Those are the only two airplanes I flew.
Okay, and you flew the Hellcat in World War II.
Well, the Hellcat in training at California.
Okay, and then okay,
El Centro.
Hellcat.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, and so Jim, I'm going to open it up to you for a minute here and just say there is a Marine Corps connection here, if you can't tell. Yeah, if he takes his hat off, he kind of looks Marine Corps-ish anyway. But but anyway, his dad was a United States Marine Corps, and I'll turn it over to you. Go ahead, Jim.
He was stationed in Cherry Point, North Carolina. I was born on the Marine Corps base. In fact, my birth certificate has U.S. Marine Corps on it. So, yeah, I guess you could say I was born into the Corps, you know.
And talk to us a little bit about your airplane. I mean, we'll start out just with the colors. You know, it's close to authentic, but it was a family affair from what I understand.
It was. And I encourage any critiques, by the way.
Yeah.
The aircraft, it is painted in what we call deep sea blue. It was a military color. Dad really liked the deep sea blue as opposed to the blue gray that was the actual color in Korea. Yeah. This aircraft served on the USS Boxer and Valley Forge and the Oriskany aircraft carriers during Korea during the same time frame. And it's funny, I was talking to the colonel earlier, and I shared some of the names and some of the folks that I met through this aircraft, and there was common occurrences that we knew the same people. We found six pilots flew this in combat, got copies of the records, and just really incredible search. When we bought the airplane in 1981, we didn't have any clue of its history. Dad went up to the Naval Archives, researched the bureau number, and started to find all the different combat missions this aircraft was in. So it has a lot. But the color, this was what my dad's favorite color was, deep sea blue, and that's what this color
is. Beautiful. I got to say, I appreciate this color. You picked the right one. Yeah. And there is a possibility that you may have flown this airplane, from what I understand. I think we did a little bit more research, and there's two active Corsairs out there flying right now that you did fly. Is that correct?
Sir, right. Yes, sir. Right.
Okay. And they're on the air show circuit, if you will. And, yep. All right, so tell us more about the airplane acquisition, and you've been flying it for a long time. Like I said, he flies here all the time. It's wonderful to watch him. He didn't fly last night, though, I found out. You saw his airplane fly last night, but what was it? You wanted to have dinner?
Well, you know, I'm very busy. I'm on the board, EAA, Warbirds of America, so there's always activities. And, oh, by the way, I'm flying, and I'm in charge of all the Corsairs flying this afternoon. So my plate gets loaded very very high. And I'm also a Navy legacy pilot, so I'm flying with the Growlers, the F-18s coming in. So everything's very busy, and everything is hitting at that 5, 6, 7 o'clock time frame. And so I finally told somebody, I said, I got to take my wife to dinner. Can you jump in my airplane? Yes, I'm supposed to fly last night, but can you do this sortie? It's the twilight, which is the beginning of the night show. And, of course, Scott Scooter Yoke says, yep, I'll do it, yep, I'll do it, I'll do it. So this aircraft has been flown, obviously, in the military, but in civilian life, my father, myself, and Scott Yoke. That's the only three people that have been in this aircraft to fly it. And so, at any rate, I got to have dinner with my wife and my daughter last night. And I made it back just in time because it was an 8:15 departure. And I actually saw my airplane fly without me.
But that will change today.
It will change today.
He will be the flight lead for, and we're not sure exactly how many Corsairs we're going to go by. But
we don't know the final number, but I'm actually flying the lead. There's two different flights. One is with three Corsairs, be myself and two wingmen. And I have VF Hudner's squadron, 32.
32.
VF-32 brought in a Hornet, a F-18 Super Hornet, and that aircraft will be flying with me.
Outstanding.
And then all the rest of the Corsairs will be in a different flight, same time frame, doing circles out here at 325 today.
Outstanding. Well, just again, a quick walk around. You want to do a quick walk around the airplane? I mean, I know there's some people out there that want to know the hardware stuff, so go ahead and just walk around the airplane. Just point out a few things that might be a little bit different. Like the same, you can see the gun ports, have been blanked. You can see that little leading edge. We already talked about that for the stall. But go ahead.
I just want to expand a little bit. When we were talking about Korea and the different low-level flights, the Corsair was very effective. It was a very, very good tool for close air support. And so the Chinese, the Vietcong, whatever, they saw this as a big threat. So they were doing anything to try and take out this airplane. And being that we had six pilots that flew it in combat, I would ask the pilots, you know, Mr. Hank, what happened? What did you do? And they would string cables across the mountains to try and catch the Corsairs. And one day, one of the pilots flying this aircraft caught one of those cables. Now, it was supposed to bring down the aircraft, but it didn't. The cable got caught up into the propeller, just broke the cable. The aircraft made its strike, put out its rockets, napalm. There was bombs. There was 50 caliber. Made it back to the ship, landed on the carrier with the cable still wrapped around the prop. So that's a testament to this aircraft and what it can take out in the field and still make it back to the ship. So that was one story that I really enjoyed hearing. So this aircraft is a Dash 4 Corsair, and it started out with a Dash 1, and they learned all the different aspects about a Dash 1. So this involved a lot of enhancements, which you'll see some Corsairs with three-bladed props. This has a fourth blade. This was the first variation that had the fourth blade propeller. Aircraft service ceiling is 41,000 feet, and so the added propeller gave it just a little bit better performance. So that's why you'll see the difference between a four-blade and a three-blade. And from this variation on, the Dash 5, Dash 7s all carried the four-blade propeller. The engine and propeller was the largest engine-propeller combination at the time. So Chance Vought used that in this airframe. And so the initial concept was to have a straight wing. And if you can visualize this aircraft with a straight wing, the gear would be so long that it never would survive carrier operations. So the designers looked and said, we have to reduce something. So they ended up deciding to put a gull in the wing, and the whole purpose is to reduce the length of the landing gear so it can survive carrier operations. So that's why the gull was put in the wing. The next question is, well, does it enhance the performance of the aircraft? Not really. It looks cool. Everybody likes the gull wing. But it wasn't a positive, it wasn't a negative. It was just a different design aspect. And then you can see there's different oil coolers, intercoolers to the aircraft.
There's a unique sound of a Corsair. In fact, didn't they call it the Whistling Death?
Whistling Death.
Where'd that come from?
Whistling Death, because when it came out initially in the Japanese theater, the Corsairs came in, and when they would dive between the 50 calibers, the oil cooler, the intercooler, the aircraft would whistle, I'd say right around 300 knots. And so when the Japanese heard this whistle, they associated it to death. So they called it a Whistling Death. When they heard the whistle, they just scattered everywhere else. So that was one of the nicknames. The other was Hose Nose, because the nose was so long, it intimidated a lot of pilots. So that was another nickname it had, was Hose Nose.
Well, that made it more difficult to land on the carrier, of course.
Extremely.
Also, right? I mean, because you can't see what's in front of you, and now you're trying to land on this little boat
down
there.
On a pitching deck.
Yeah, so did you have, I mean, was it more difficult to fly this on a carrier?
I really didn't fly a lot off the carrier. I really didn't. But, you know, you had to be in a turn the whole time around to see the landing signal officer. And so if you didn't do that, you couldn't land.
Huh.
Couldn't, you know.
Interesting. Interesting. All right, what else?
For many years, this aircraft was in Korea. There was a standard configuration. This is, you know, this is my spare set of wings. My actual wings are being repaired right now, so I don't have the machine guns and also the rocket rails. This aircraft has rocket rails, so you have four on this side, four on that side, eight rocket rails for 5-inch HVAR. That's high-velocity aircraft rockets. With the rockets, eight rockets, the 650 caliber machine guns, and underneath you see two pylons. One was for a drop tank, and the other was for a 500-pounder, 1,000-pound Tiny Tim, which you probably remember.
Yeah.
And so that was a standard configuration. The drop tank took you to destination, wherever it was. Drop the drop tank. You have full fuel. Make your, you know, your sorties, whatever it may be, trains, power plants, whatever, and then have enough fuel to get back to the ship. So the aircraft, my dad would fly for many years with eight 5-inch HVARs, double drop tanks, and it really looked heavy. It was a really amazing look. So the aircraft carried a lot of ordnance, and that's why it was so successful in close air support for the troops on the ground.
Okay. I'm going to say it's about time, so I'm going to stop the official discussion right now and open it up to questions, and questions for anybody or everybody. I'll say now, there's one right away. Adam will be back in the merchandise building to sign his book back there. I highly recommend everybody go see the movie. And indeed, it is an honor for me to be here. And I learned something in every one of these productions. There's no question. Nope. Questions.
Ed, by the way, Joe is going to be signing with me. So if you want to get a book today, maybe you already have it. Maybe you just want to do your Christmas shopping now. Joe will autograph the books. So my signature will take a couple dollars of value off your book. He'll bring it back and double it.
So outstanding.
Do your Christmas shopping today with us.
Well, thank you. All right, questions. We're open. Go ahead, right there.